This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last week, author and journalist Walter Isaacson delivered the 43rd Annual Jefferson Lecture, that is the government's highest honor for achievement in the humanities. He delivered it to a packed house at Washington's Kennedy Center. And Walter Isaacson is best known, as you know, for his biographies. He's chronicled the lives of Benjamin Franklin, Albert Einstein, Steve Jobs. He addressed his lecture to my fellow humanists, but his message wasn't just for humanists. What made Jobs, Einstein, and Franklin so successful, Isaacson explained, is that they weren't one thing. They weren't just scientists or humanists. They were both. And Isaacson says the future belongs to those who can follow their example. Walter Isaacson is the CEO of the Aspen Institute. His most recent book is Steve Jobs. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Science Friday, Walter.
Hey, Ira, it's great to be back with you. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Previous Jefferson lectures have taken up this topic, the relationship between the humanities and the sciences. Some have not very nice things to say about science. Is this why you jumped into the conversation?
I remember 25 years ago, I took the train down from New York to hear one of my heroes, Walker Percy, the Southern novelist, give the Jefferson lecture. And he began by saying that the sciences have nothing to teach us about our existence. It's only the humanists who can really touch our soul. Now, I knew that Walker Percy was a doctor, a medical doctor, and all of his novels, the brilliance of them comes from standing at that intersection you just talked about between the humanities and the sciences. So I wanted not necessarily ever to criticize the great late Dr. Walker Percy, but to say, no, it's the people who can do both, and not only do both, but connect both of them. That's where the creativity lies, as it did with Steve Jobs.
Yeah, I remember I was rereading your first part of your book there, and he made that very specific statement, and I was just reading your speech at the same time, and I was wondering if that informed you, or was that, in doing the research and writing,
absolutely
stuck in your mind there?
Absolutely. I remember when I first started working with Steve Jobs on the biography, he said to me, I was a humanities kid growing up. I loved, you know, the arts and the humanities, but I also liked electronics. And he said, I remember reading something Edwin Land, the guy who invented Polaroid, said, which is, if you can stand at that intersection, that's where creativity occurs. And I realized that every single one of Steve Jobs' product presentations, from the iPod to the iPhone to the iPad, he ends with that street sign slide of the street sign connecting the liberal arts and technology. And he said, that's where our soul is at Apple. And it began, you know, sometimes you're writing biographies for 20, 30 years, and you don't see a theme that's in front of your eyes. But I realized that was true of Franklin, it was true of Einstein, and it was true, of course, of anybody in the tradition of Leonardo da Vinci and his Vitruvian Man, who knows that science really does connect us to the humanities and vice versa. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that this idea, this intersection, is something that people especially need to hear now?
Absolutely. You know, I love Albert Einstein, having written about him, but one of the downsides of Einstein was that he made science seem intimidating. Unlike you, Ira, you know, people got kind of frightened with relativity theory and then, you know, Niels Bohr's indeterminacy and Heisenberg's uncertainty and Gödel's incompleteness. And all of a sudden, science wasn't like it was in the days of Newton, when it was kind of mechanical and there was, you know, laws of motion and things that a Jefferson or a Ben Franklin could understand. So I think we became intimidated in the late 20th century by science. But nowadays, with a digital revolution, a biotech revolution, discussions on net neutrality and how does the internet work, it really helps where if you're a humanist and you start saying, well, I love Hamlet and I think people who don't love Latin and Hamlet or, you know, Philistines, to realize, yeah, but do you know C++ coding? Do you know the difference between a transistor and a diode or between a gene and a chromosome? Those are things that humanists have forgotten that maybe they should delve into.
And, you know, it's funny you bring that up. You could take 4 years at Harvard and never study science and think you had a well-rounded education.
Absolutely. And there are very few people who study science at Harvard and don't do a little bit of the liberal arts and the humanities. So I think the onus, as C.P. Snow originally said, falls a little bit more on the humanists who think that the humanities can teach us so much, and they are right. The humanities can, but then they don't make the next step to say, I should try to understand technology, engineering, and the sciences the way I believe scientists should try to understand the humanities.
Maybe you could offer, you know, there are language requirements when you go to college. Maybe you could, instead of saying taking French, Latin, or German, you could take C++ code or something like
that. I would think that the ability to write an algorithm and to code some instruction sets, whether it's in C++ or BASIC or some clear programming language, is so crucial to understanding the logic of how computers work and how we're going to deal in the digital age, that with all due respect to people who say you got to learn Latin, I would say, yeah, but teach coding as well.
Mm. What are the values of the humanities to you? What do they bring to your table?
You know, in this digital age, computers have been shown to do almost everything except for be creative, imaginative, and to think. Every now and then you read about artificial, every 50 years, I mean, for the past 50 years, people are saying we're about to get artificial intelligence where machines will be just like humans. No, it hasn't happened. If you look at Ada Lovelace, Lord Byron's daughter, she was the first in this line of people to say humans will bring the creativity and the computers will bring the processing power. So what humanities brings to the party is a simple phrase that Steve Jobs used over and over again, perhaps to the chagrin of his English teacher, which is think different. An algorithm is never going to think different, almost by definition. But we humans can be imaginative and creative. What teaches us that? The poetry of Ada Lovelace's father, Lord Byron, or the plays of Shakespeare. So being creative, imaginative, I think is exactly what humans have to bring to this party. But they do it by standing at that intersection with technology.
Mm. You're working on a new book, The Innovators. Is this the theme?
It's definitely the theme, and I've snuck in the first chapter to you because it begins with a chapter on Ada Lovelace, who, as I said, was Lord Byron's daughter. As you may know, by the time she was growing up, Lady Byron was not that fond of Lord Byron, and so tried to make sure that Ada did not become a poet and tutored her only in mathematics. But Ada Lovelace became somebody who loved both math and poetry, and she helps conceive of the programming for her friend Charles Babbage's difference and analytical engines. And by doing so, she realizes that a computer is not just going to do numbers, but as she put it, can weave patterns just like a loom can weave a picture, can do words, can do music, can do anything that can be notated symbolically. That is the core of the information age. I try to do in my next book, it's out in October, start with Ada Lovelace, but go all the way through the people who invented the computer, the teamwork that went into inventing the computer and the internet, and how that involved both poetry and processors, all the way through the invention of Google.
Mm-hmm. You talk about artificial intelligence. It is really sort of the wrong direction. Trying to replace people with computers is not the best use of both people or computers.
Exactly. And that was a great theme started by Ada Lovelace and certainly picked up by people who aren't that famous, but named, you know, people like J.C.R. Licklider, Doug Engelbart, Alan Kay, of course, at Xerox PARC is better known. These are people who say that the interface, the connection, the intimate connection between humans and technology will always be able to do more than machines just on their own or humans just on their own. And even Garry Kasparov and the people who did Watson and Deep Blue and the chess-playing machines and the Jeopardy-playing machines realize that the combination of humans and machines is going to be more successful. That sort of encounter, and this is something that I try to explain in my next book, to the tradition of Alan Turing and then the people who invented the field of artificial intelligence, who said that the primary goal should just be having machines that can think like us and eventually, when the singularity comes, replace us.
It's a lot.
Not
of,
you, Ira. No, I just no, meant the rest
no,
of
I,
us.
No, there are a lot of, you know, the science fiction world is now just full of books about the singularity. In different
Absolutely. They'll never replace, though, I assure you, the ability to host Science Friday.
They're trying. why is that? Why can they not? What are the characteristics of computers that can't replace people?
Well, as I said, first of all, if you're using an algorithm, it tends to be rules-based. And there's something about the human brain that's neither digital nor binary.
Yeah.
It has analog systems as well as digital systems. There's a lot of maybes and nuances in there. Someday you could probably reverse engineer the human brain and do in wetware and carbonware what we're now trying to do with silicon. That perhaps 50, 100 years from now could be done. I'm not sure why that should be the goal. And secondly, I can look back, starting in 1956 when the field of artificial intelligence came up. They're always saying in 20 years this will happen. Even the perceptron that was trying to reverse engineer the human brain in 1957, 58, they said it will soon think and talk and be imaginative like humans. Even in last December, you could read a lot of newspaper stories about neuromorphic types of chips that were going to replace the chips we have and be like a human brain. Maybe it will happen, but you know, every time they say it's 20 years away, 20 years comes and they say it's 20 years away. So in the meantime, while you and I are still important, you know, humans are still important, I think we can look at it as a receding mirage and concentrate instead on what Doug Engelbart and Licklider called that intimate connection between humans and machines.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least it's not like nuclear fusion, which is always 30 years away. So
exactly. Well, you know, it's maybe good that everything should be 20 years away.
Science is coming under a lot of attack from politicians, from people who think that science is just a matter of opinion these days. Is there any role for artists and writers and humanists to think about how they might, the benefit of them to sort of helping to defend science?
You know, that's another reason I think those of us who love the humanities, who grew up with a humanities background, should have a deep feel for science, and not only science, but the scientific method. The notion of let the experiment be made, as Ben Franklin said when he noticed a similarity between sparks and lightning, and you come up with a lightning rod. You know, what we don't have is what Ben Franklin used to do with public policy. When he said, what about the poor laws? Does that discourage work, or does that make for a more equitable society? And Franklin said, let the experiment be made. And they tested in various towns, in various places in England and the United States, the difference in the poor and welfare laws and what it did to the economy. I think that respect for the scientific method that was a core of the founding of our nation has been lost in our body politic today.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Walter Isaacson, CEO of the Aspen Institute, author of recent book, Steve Jobs, new book, The Innovators, comes out this fall. Can you give us a little hint of who the innovators are going to be in that book?
Well, as I say, it starts with Ada Lovelace. These are not as famous as some of the other people I've written about. But certainly when you get to the 1940s and 50s, the invention of the computer, you have these amazingly interesting people like Alan Turing, John von Neumann, Prosper Eckert, and John Markley, John Atanasoff. But the interesting thing to me is that we biographers, Ira, we realize we distort history slightly. We play up the role of the singular individual sitting in a garage or garret and a light bulb goes off in that person's head and some innovation occurs. True innovation in the digital age, but even before, usually comes from collaboration, teamwork, this ability of somebody like a Steve Jobs to work with a Wozniak or an Eckert to work with a Markley, people who can be theorists and work with engineers and maybe even poets and humanists to help create beautiful products. Likewise, the internet was developed collaboratively. With all due respect to people who make jokes about Al Gore, it was actually a wonderful team of people who developed the internet. And I go all the way through to Larry Page and Sergey Brin and Tim Berners-Lee, who created the web and Google and the web. Those are the type of people who knew how to do collaborative creativity. We use the word innovation so much these days, it's become a buzzword. It's lost all meaning. It's sort of, let's have an innovation conference. So I wanted to look at real people who invented real things and say, how did they work with other people to be innovative, to be creative?
Do you think that the internet is a prime factor now that it's been around, that it is promoting that intersection between science and the humanities more than anything
Absolutely.
Before it?
Absolutely. And I think to be truly a citizen of the net, it helps to understand the science and technology of the net. And people like my daughter, you know, who love the humanities, but she made sure she knows coding and she knows how the internet works. So I think it's really a new generation is catching on to this. But the main thing about the internet was that it was developed by the Defense Department, ARPA, many other groups, in order to facilitate collaboration. And especially the World Wide Web, which came along later. Tim Berners-Lee said, I wanted people all over the world to help me finish my sentences. In other words, when you're bouncing ideas around and brainstorming, people say, yeah, and maybe this and that. And so with the internet, different people with different creative talents, some of them artists, some of them technicians, can all work together more collaboratively, and that's the beauty of the internet.
And so, as going back to C.P. Snow's Two Cultures, is there a way to get people to try to talk to one another from a different way? Any suggestions on how to do that?
Yeah, well, first of all, we should increase the ratings of Science Friday, but not just joking. It shows like this, and why I write books about an Einstein or Steve Jobs or the innovators, is maybe if we make into our heroes the people who are creative, imaginative, and like Steve Jobs, thought that beauty mattered, make them into our heroes because they know how to connect with science and technology, you know, whether it's on the radio or in the media or in the books we write or how we teach at school. I think celebrating that notion, as opposed to some of your friends and mine who don't know much about science, they consider themselves very educated people in the humanities, and they're willing to joke, almost brag, that they don't know the difference between an integral or differential equation, or they don't know how a transistor works.
Yeah, and they're proud of that.
Walter, you know, they should not be proud of it.
Yeah, they are. I agree with you. Walter, thank you so much. We're going to be looking forward to the innovators coming out this fall. And thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Ira, it's always great to be with you.
Walter Isaacson, CEO of the Aspen Institute, author of the biography Steve Jobs, his new book, The Innovators, coming out this fall. And you can watch Walter's Jefferson Lecture on our website. We've got a link to it at Science Friday.com/Jefferson Lecture.